Mini episode 772 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by Sportsology, delivering unconventional columns and webcasts about sports, TV, music, movies, and more. Follow them on the web at sportsology.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 772. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris here today, along with another one of our great FDH Lounge dignitaries, Steve Callis. Of course, you can catch him any number of places. He currently continues to have a podcast at thespn.net. You can check him out there, as has been the case for years. Additionally now, the new Sportsology podcast with Joe Stazak on Tuesdays. And from time to time, WFAN in New York, SNY in New York, any number of places. My good friend, Steve Callis. Steve, good to have you back on today as we break down the 2016 World Series.
Great to be with you as always, Rick. And I know you you have to be especially excited now that the Indians are finally in the World Series, just like the Cubs.
I certainly am. And I'll tell you what, it's a thing where, again, you'll understand this. For somebody who watches the National League as much as you do, people in Cleveland, where I'm at, might not understand this quite as much. But, you know, kind of felt a little dirty during the NLCS here, rooting for the Dodgers as much as I was. Under normal circumstances, I would not have a problem with the Cubs. Everybody has been all butthurt in Cleveland over the last couple of days about the Cubs stuff here. But, you know, you had to expect that that was going to be coming and that that's going to be the bigger story. And the longest drought is going to trump the second longest drought and all of that. And we've lost the whole Cleveland misery thing since the Cavs won. And if you want to go even deeper than that, the Monsters winning the Calder Cup, Stipe becoming the baddest man on the planet with the UFC World Heavyweight Championship. So, you know, it's understandable that we've kind of lost the underdog thing here, even though it is the longest streak in the American League as far as not winning the World Series. And it's a streak in its own right, but I was rooting for the Dodgers because, again, particularly the way it was going to go, Kershaw was probably going to be unlikely to go three games in the World Series. Definitely the easier matchup of the two. The Cubs were my preseason pick to win the World Series. I think they may have been yours as well. And
That's right. For
people who don't really understand, you know, who don't really follow the National League like you and I do, that series, I think, bore out a lot of why, if you're an Indians fan, this is not what you wanted to see.
I think that's definitely right, but I have to say you sound a lot like Jason Kipnis, and you probably know the story, being in Cleveland. Kipnis is a Chicago kid. He went to Glenbrook North High School, and believe it or not, this is the fun fact for the World Series. Not only did Jason Kipnis grow up on the same street as Steve Bartman, he went to school with Steve Bartman's sister. So I just find that, and Kipnis even said he had it. Kipnis said he had a tear in his eye when the Cubs won the pennant. But of course, he essentially said that he was hoping that the Dodgers had won the series. But I think on more of a baseball level, I think you're right. I think the Cubs are a much tougher matchup. Look, a lot of people, including you and I, thought the Cubs were the best team before the season started, and it looks like through the regular season up to now they probably are, and I would think that the Indians are the underdog in this series.
They certainly are by the Vegas measurement and any other number of places that you look in terms of the major pundits out there. The picks across the board have pretty much been with the Cubs, and that's the percentage way to go, to be sure. I mean, the way to envision the Indians winning this is continuing the magic that they've had going through the American League playoffs. And we'll get to that part. But I know when you look at the NLCS, there's a lot that you can look at and say, well, it's the greatness of this Cubs lineup up and down the line and the balance that they have and Madden's strategies and everything like that. But in the end, regardless of what it was, a Clayton Kershaw that was getting a lot of praise for turning the corner in the postseason looked actually a lot worse than ordinary when it counted the most in Game 6.
Yeah, I have to say, and look, Clayton Kershaw is a stand-up guy. I've heard him say multiple times, I have no excuses for my past in the postseason. It's not about pitching too much. It's not about rest or no rest. In fact, his numbers, as you probably know, in the playoffs are better on short rest than normal rest or long rest. But his ERA in the seventh inning is still like in the 20s. And I guess here's my concern. When the Dodgers won the division series and Kershaw came in relief, and my goodness, all credit, right? Relief the next day, got the final two guys out, et cetera, et cetera. But the announcer said when they won, Clayton Kershaw had two wins and a save, and that just wasn't true, Rick. And to go over quickly, and this is not the best Clayton Kershaw, I'm one of the guys who says that to me, Clayton Kershaw at this point in his career is Koufax-like. And everybody says, old-timers say, oh, don't compare anyone. I think Sandy Koufax, and for better or worse, I'm old enough to have seen Sandy Koufax, admittedly against the horrific Mets in the mid-60s, but Koufax to me is the greatest pitcher ever, period. So I understand why some people, including Mike Francesa in New York, oh, don't compare Kershaw. But in the regular season, if you look at their numbers, Kershaw is stunning. You know, his career win percentage, and he's on his way to having the greatest win percentage ever for a starting pitcher, is .677. And that's better than Koufax's, but as you know, Koufax wasn't so good early in his career. But my point is, in this year's playoffs, where everyone said, ESPN said they turned the corner and he's done everything they wanted him to do, but in reality, in that first win, he gave up three earned runs in five innings, only pitched five innings, was winning 4-3 when he left, and got the win, and good for him. In the next game, as you probably know, he was winning 5-2, left the game with the bases loaded. They left him in to pitch to Bryce Harper. He walked Harper. Now, I think he might have struck out Harper on the 2-2 pitch. But then those three runs scored. So he gave up five earned and got a no decision. And then he made the save. So his ERA in that playoff series was 4.44 or something like that. I'm sorry, 5.84 for that series, and for the playoffs this year, 4.44. So look, I give him a lot of credit coming out of the bullpen. He did pitch that gem against the Cubs, but then when push came to shove here, yes, the guy made an error in the first inning, or the first inning, I think, but he was just not good. So I'm taking nothing away from Kershaw, but I've called him at times the Peyton Manning of the playoffs, one of the greatest, if not the greatest, regular season, whatever you want, pitcher QB. But in the playoffs, not so much. And even though Manning walked away with his second Super Bowl, not to talk football, he wasn't the reason they were in the Super Bowl, and he wasn't the reason they won the Super Bowl. So, again, not to bash Kershaw in the big picture, he's a stand-up guy, but he, to me, did not have a very good playoff series this year. He did have spots, moments, but he was not good overall, and that's the reality of it all.
Right, and what the Cubs did to him Saturday night, again, should really send shivers down the spines of any Indians fans. It certainly does with myself. You look at how it went. My initial predictions were, I was one of the few, it seems like, to have picked Indians to get past Boston. I thought Toronto would go down to Texas, and then I thought Texas would probably take out the Indians, because to me, Texas was probably about the closest thing to the Cubs in the American League in terms of balance, in terms of looking at that roster and the depth of it, and figuring that they would have ways to match up that would be very hard to beat. Not on the level of the Cubs, but I thought it was the closest thing in the American League. I would argue that the Indians kind of dodged a bullet there, subsequently getting both the Red Sox and Toronto and a couple of these power-based teams that, again, everyone looked at what a juggernaut Boston was with that power offense, and then they certainly were. I'm not taking anything away from them, but it's a little bit of, you know, you get to this October magic with the pitching, with the defense, some of the ways that you can basically try and put the kibosh on something that can be a little bit all or nothing. And I think Toronto is a little more all or nothing than Boston. And you kind of saw how that played out over the course of the series. There were times when it looked like the series could get away from the Indians. Had the bullpen game not worked, when Trevor Bauer had to come out after the drone injury, it could have been something there. There were some thoughts that losing the game with Corey Kluber could have been the tipping point the other way. In the end, Indians hanging on, getting the job done. All they really needed to do against Toronto was get it to Andrew Miller and then subsequently Cody Allen. And they benefit a lot from the rest. There's a lot of concern about the rest versus rust factor, but if you're going to manage a game the way that Terry Francona has to, and to kind of not cheat ethically, but cheat in terms of trying to squeeze more out of guys than you necessarily should, at least on paper. That's the only way to get through the playoffs thus far. That's the only way to try and match up against the Cubs, is to try to keep this magic going in every way that they can.
Well, I think Francona and Maddon are the two best managers in baseball. Francona's already a Hall of Famer. I see some people saying, oh, if he can win a championship with the Cleveland Indians, then he's in the Hall of Fame. I think he's already in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
We're already breaking the Boston jinx. And if you're going to put GMs in the Hall of Fame, I don't know if they are, but I think if Theo Epstein wins, you know, if the Cubs win, they should, like, build a statue halfway between Chicago and Boston, whatever city that is.
Yeah.
They should just build
that
a statue of Theo. They should just build a statue of Theo Epstein. But having said all of that, yeah, it is interesting. Clearly, to me, the two best managers, and have been. You know, Joe Maddon is a little quirky. You know, the weird things he has. But to me, he's the one manager. You know how they say Casey Stengel really was the guy who started the platoon system in the late 40s and 50s with the Yankees. I think Maddon is the guy who revolutionized the game in terms of the shift. And I remember, and we've talked about this, watching a Yankee game 2 or 3 years ago where on opening day they said, oh, we're seeing now the shift is becoming something and the Yankees might start to do it. And I remember writing an article saying the defensive revolution has been televised for 2 years because Joe Maddon has already done this for 300 games. So I think Maddon and Francona are the two best. I don't want to put them one over the other, although Francona has the rings, and, you know, that kind of counts for something. But, yeah, it's amazing what he's done with Cleveland. I had picked the Cubs over Cleveland before the season started and before the playoffs started, and I had to admit, and I had to admit that the Indians before the playoffs, my comment was, I won't change my pick now, but I don't know how they're going to do it with the pitching the way it is. You know, Carrasco gone, Salazar, who was not good in the second half but was an all-star in the first half, gone. And they did it with smoke and mirrors. I mean, you have to – the relief game is one of the great games of all time. But I think we're also seeing a new thing this year, and that is the change of the relief pitcher. And I would point to two guys. Everybody, of course, knows about Andrew Miller. And what infuriates the Yankee fan in me, and we don't want to talk about the Yankees, but – this arguably is Aroldis Chapman. I understand Allen's the closer, but Miller can close. He can pitch in the fifth, the seventh. And that's what he was at the Yankees. You'll recall this year for a while anyway, the Yankees had Miller in the seventh, Betances in the eighth, and Chapman in the ninth. And when Chapman was on suspension, Miller was the closer. And when he came back, Chapman is, you know, I'm a closer. And Miller's like, pitch me wherever you want. I think that laid the groundwork for putting him in the fifth inning or the seventh inning or for two and a third or with men on base. And the other guy I'll mention is Jansen on the Dodgers. You saw, Rick, they brought him in the seventh inning one game. They brought him in the sixth inning one game, and he's the closer. Now go way back to the days of Bruce Sutter and Goose Gossage and Sparky Lyle. They come in the seventh inning with one out and the bases loaded. That's what closers did back then, but it's a different world now. But now I think there might be an attempted change back with guys like Miller and Jansen. To think maybe, you know the theory, sometimes the game's decided in the seventh inning, not the ninth. And most guys play it by the book. The most famous one, Buck Showalter. You know, I think Buck Showalter is a great manager. I really do. He deserves a World Series. But, you know, to lose that game with his best reliever, best pitcher, arguably the Cy Young winner of Britain in the American League, to lose that game in the 11th inning with your closer still in the bullpen was just a colossal blunder. But I think these guys, Miller and Jansen, and the way they're used are going to change that. Even though Buck said it wasn't a philosophical thing, I think it was, because you don't want to use your closer until you have the lead. So I think we're seeing a minor revolution in relief pitching, and I think Andrew Miller is the poster boy for that. And still angry because, as you know, the Indians have him for the next 2 years at $9 million a year. That's chump change for what Andrew Miller is.
Oh, absolutely. And I want to expand on that point there. Although, as we talked about off the air, some prime prospects that the Yankees got from the Indians, I believe also from the Cubs for the Chapman deal, long overdue rebuilding on the Yankees' part, and they've been able to do it largely on the fly. So the Yankees have been, quite frankly, luckier than they deserve to be in terms of not having to take a knee for a significant period of time with that by making these deals. My only quibble about the thing with the managers, and I agree with you generally, I'd also put Bruce Bochy on that level. You look at what he's won three World Series titles with, and I put him in the conversation as well. I think those three guys in whatever order are your top tier. Interestingly, Madden, the year after Francona's second World Series, did beat him in the American League Championship Series to make it for his previous pennant. So that's kind of an interesting little twist as well, and how sewn in both Francona and Madden now both are with the whole Theo Epstein school and how everything's gone. But what you were saying about the bullpen there, there's a convergence that's really interesting. I saw Brian Kenny talking about on MLB Network your point about the leverage situations and how an Andrew Miller, you know, sabermetrics will tell you that it's a good thing to break it up and not just wait till the ninth inning. But that's also, as you say, an old school kind of a thing right there. You mentioned Lyle and Gossage and guys like that. So it's one of these rare things where sabermetrics and the old school actually kind of coincide there. And the better organizations, I think, and I'm still not ready to put over the Tribe organization as a whole, because I think particularly like when you look at the outfield, there's a phrase that I don't want to use, but it ends with into chicken salad. And I think Theo has, Terry Francona has done a lot of that with the Indians, of turning a lot of things into chicken salad. But the better organizations / managerial crews, and again, I think Mickey Callaway is the best in the game as far as being a pitcher's coach, they will figure out a way to do something like that with Miller that kind of blends the best of both old school and new school.
Yeah, but the difference to me in today's game is what Miller is mentally. Yeah, I don't have to pitch in the ninth inning for the Yankees. I'm happy to pitch the seventh. You pitch me wherever you want. So he goes to Cleveland with that attitude. Francona has expanded on that seventh, eighth, ninth inning kind of deal. He also has a good closer in Allen, by the way. You need one of those. But my concern, I think other teams are going to try this, but I don't think there are many Andrew Millers who selflessly – I think not only is he the best reliever in the game, I think he's the most versatile reliever in the game. That's obvious now. But I don't know if you can give it, for example, Chapman's not going to do that. And a lot of people have complained, and you've heard them over the years, a lot of closers, oh, I don't want to pitch in a non-closing situation. Oh, I don't want to pitch with a man on base. Oh, I don't want to pitch before the ninth inning. So while I agree that there will be an attempt to go back to the way it was, I don't know how many Andrew Millers there are, and I'm not talking about his talent as a relief pitcher. I'm talking about his mental willingness to pitch any time, any inning, any situation. There's not many guys like that.
Well, my theory going forward is that, because again, I think whatever you want to call it, the Cleveland media has sort of dubbed it the super reliever, whatever we're going to dub this floating kind of high leverage guy for the mid to late innings, who is not performing as a standard closer. My first guess is that it's going to be pitchers who are not done with their development. Say if you got a kid coming off a really good year at Double-A, but he's only got two pitches that you can really kind of count on at this point. My guess is that's how he maybe gets worked into the rotation. Rather than risk getting batted around in the starting rotation if he doesn't have a full complement of pitches yet, try him out in that role, give him a year, kind of stretch his arm a little bit as much as you can, and then maybe go back to starting the next year. So my guess is that that's what it'll be for right now, is prospects who are still kind of undeveloped, because Andrew Miller, more or less by his own admission, is a failed starter. He was asked recently in the media about going back to that, and he said, well, I think the ship kind of sailed on that. He doesn't have the third pitch that's going to get you through the lineup time in and time out, and to his credit, he knows that.
Absolutely, as was, for example, Mariano Rivera.
Yes, absolutely. That's why he's a closer. Now, that's a great call. That's a great call. And guys like that, and it's interesting that Pedro Martinez said on TBS that Andrew Miller was pitching perhaps even at a higher level than he had seen out of Rivera back in the day. Just to be in that conversation, obviously, you know, things are very good when you're looking at that. So that's one of the key things that the Indians bring to bear. If there's an advantage anywhere in this series, it would be that the Cubs, while having a good bullpen, don't necessarily have a monster like Miller to get you through those innings. Then again, with their big edge in starting pitching on paper, they may not need that as much. They're going to be hoping to get more innings out of their starters. For the Indians, it could be mix and match a couple of different games here. Trevor Bauer, who knows how much he's going to have in him here with his finger after the drone accident. So he's going to give it a try again, but it could be another river of blood out on the pitcher's mound and perhaps another short night. Danny Salazar, as we're recording this, probably coming back, but will it be in a long relief role akin to Andrew Miller, or will it be a start a game? We don't know. The one thing paradoxically that the Indians might be best served doing is Ryan Merritt, going with him again. And by the way, a very, very neat story there that I don't know how much it got out there nationally. I think it did somewhat. It got out a lot locally. Indians fans finding his wedding registry online, buying him everything on there, him and his fiance. And then there were Indians fans tweeting, like, I bought them their washcloths. I bought them their turkey fire. So it was pretty cool to see that. When you hear about great sports fans and how much they care, I would defy some other city to go top something like that. But I would think he might be the best bet for one of these spots here as you're going through the rotation. You got to figure Kluber is going games 1, 4, and 7. And obviously game 1 takes on disproportionate importance for the Indians because of that. But Merritt in one of the other games here, this is a really, really weird stat, is that he didn't pitch over 87.2 miles per hour with any of his fastballs in the 4 1/3 innings against Toronto, which is right about what you would expect for him. Somebody who I'd say fringe starting pitching prospect would be very, very kind, quite frankly. But Toronto was fourth in baseball, fourth from the bottom in baseball, in batting average against fastballs under 90 miles an hour. The Cubs were 30th out of 30. I don't know what would account for something like that. Steve, I know for as much time as you've spent in the game playing, coaching, analyzing, really everything, I don't know if you have a theory for that, if it just goes to the whole kind of thing about susceptibility to off-speed pitches or something like that. If there's a general sense that the Cubs can be had in that way, that's good news for the Indians, not merely for Merritt, but also very critically for Josh Tomlin.
Yeah, I do have a theory on that, and the theory is this. For the last 20 years now, I'll say, speed has been everything. If you're a young pitcher in the last 20 years, you want to throw as hard as you can for as long as you can. You want to light up the radar gun. And you've heard the critique from time to time. You shouldn't worry about the radar gun. You should learn how to pitch, location, 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 change speeds. And I totally agree with that. But it's the Jamie Moyer world. Jamie Moyer would not be signed today. In fact, it's interesting that Merritt even got to the major leaguers, because you're not really scouting, in my knowledge, you're not really scouting anymore for pitchers. You're scouting for guys who throw 95, and we'll teach them how to pitch. And I think because of that now, the emphasis is so much, you know, virtually every guy who comes out of the bullpen, the question is not does he throw 90, the question is does he throw 95 or 97 or 99? And I think now over time, and this is starting with kids hitting in high school and college, all you're facing is blazers. And now suddenly you come across the smart guy. I mean, Jamie Moyer pitched forever. You come across the smart guy who can't throw 95. You know, you hear about CC Sabathia, for example, this year learning to pitch without throwing 95. But there are guys, and Ryan Merritt looks like a great example to me. I would think he's going to be a long reliever in this kind of world where Francona won't have to use 7 or 8 pitchers to pitch 9 innings if Bauer starts bleeding. I would think they would bring in a guy like a Ryan Merritt. But I think that's the problem. The problem is batters no longer face junk ballers, as we used to call them, Rick. There are very few junk ballers in the major leagues because they just don't get that far. They don't even get signed anymore. And I will say this, my knowledge of it, going back maybe 10 years, is if Ryan Merritt were righty and threw as soft as he throws, he wouldn't even be scouted. They'll look at a lefty because he's lefty. But you don't see right. too many right-handed, although Hendricks is a great example also now. So you do coming to the fore in the biggest World Series you could argue there's been in 50 years because of, you know, where these teams are coming from, frankly. But Hendricks is another guy who led the league in ERA, who beat Kershaw easily in game 6, who stymies a lot of pitchers, who throws maybe 90. You know, I thought they said his average was like maybe 89 or 90, whatever. And maybe we're having another going back to the good old days where now you'll go look for a pitcher who has control, great location, not necessarily great speed. And, of course, as you know, if you have a curveball that goes 80 or 78 or an off-speed pitch, then, you know, when you throw that fastball 89-90, it looks like it's 93-94. So I do have a theory, and I think it's the correct one, although there are very few pitches to point to, although we have one on each team, maybe more than one, you're right, with Cleveland, than you normally would.
Well, yeah, and Tomlin's a guy that you wouldn't even necessarily be looking at, particularly for a three-man rotation, if everybody were healthy. But this is where we really start to get into some more of the variables, I would say, than we probably generally have going into most World Series. People are focusing on the historical oddity of the two long-suffering teams, the Cubs and the Indians, but almost as much, you have three very large injury situations. Any one of the three could be an X factor in this series. You have, as was indicated previously with Bauer and Salazar. Bauer's a guy where, again, I think he had like about a 3.02 ERA up through like July 1st and then kind of got tagged in the second half, but really started to show the kind of ace potential that made him such a high draft pick back in the day. I talk about Mickey Callaway working with guys without much pedigree. Bauer is sort of the exception to that. He is a high pedigree guy, an interesting guy. I know Arizona kind of branded him a head case, and they're probably pointing to stuff like the drone and saying, I told you so, but he's a guy who's been kind of enigmatic. If you're getting the good Trevor Bauer or the great Trevor Bauer, you're going to have a great outing. Kind of the same thing with Danny Salazar, and the one thing that I'm going to say, I'm just going to put this out there. Somebody passed this along to me, a friend of a friend who knows a major baseball media figure, so this is not for attribution directly, but that Salazar essentially sort of in the second half of the season didn't know the difference between pitching through pain and pitching through injury. You never want to pitch through injury, but the tests kept coming up back that there was nothing really wrong there and that a lot of the stuff has kind of been in his head. So that's just something I'm putting out there, but from somebody who I'm sure got that from people in the organization. So Salazar, you don't know what's going to happen. And then most surprisingly of all at this point, I think we all just figured the next time we'd be seeing Kyle Schwarber was probably in spring training of 2017, but now comes word from the Arizona Fall League. He's gotten medical clearance. He's back. The Cubs, at some point after we get done recording this, are going to make their decision today on whether he's going to be on the roster or not. I would guess that he probably would be, at least for the DH spot in Chicago. And you look at a thing here where with the fall off of Jason Hayward this year offensively, you don't have as much power in this lineup as you would have thought with him, with Schwarber. You still have the real big bombers in Rizzo and Bryant, who are both franchise players. But you put Schwarber back in the middle of that lineup for the DH games in Cleveland, and that could be a difference maker.
Well, not only that, of course, he could pinch hit in the other games. I don't know what his running is. You know he's coming back from a torn ACL and MCL in the third game of the season. But I think they would tell him not, you know, you hit a ball in the gap. I think they would tell him not to slide into second. But I think we remember what he did in the postseason. He was like, oh, my goodness, who is this guy? But you couldn't really play him in the field anyway, frankly. He was not very good in left field, to be kind. And his future may be in the American League as a DH. I don't know. But I think it would be good. You know, he's incredibly well-liked and, of course, loved by the fans of Chicago after what he did last year. I think they would probably, you know, I've read who the position players who Soler or someone would got, but I think they might just take one less pitcher for the World Series. Can they manage their bullpen with one less pitcher? I think the answer to that is yes, but I think he would be such an uplifting story. And I know they showed Theo Epstein like watching his at bats while Epstein was at the last playoff game. And apparently he's swinging the bat okay and has clearance, but literally he won't be able to do much more. If he is a pinch hitter, for example, I'm sure he'll pinch hit. If he gets on, he'll be run for. But I think as a DH, I think that would help their lineup mentally and really, because he is an incredible young hitter, admittedly on a short group. But he hit 5 home runs in the postseason. How many guys do you find like that? And by the way, that's the Cubs postseason record for home runs.
Yeah.
I always differentiate between World Series and home runs. Of course, the Cubs haven't been in the World Series in 71 years or whatever it is. So, and the other stat I also thought was interesting. So I think he will be on. The other stat I just wanted to say, this is the Cubs' 11th World Series. That means they were in 10 World Series in 1945 and before. I was not aware of that. And I think that at the time was like third all time behind the Yankees and maybe the Cardinals, I think it was. I'm not sure. But I find that to be an incredible stat also. And I'm sure we're going to get to our picks soon. But I think the Cubs just have too much starting pitching and a little too much hitting, especially now that Addison and Rizzo woke up, because they were in the funk that was going to have the Cubs lose. And then they both broke out of it at the same time.
Well, yeah, and I would kind of agree with that, and we'll get to that momentarily. One last note as far as the rosters and what they're looking at being for both places here, because, again, no DH for the games in Chicago. Schwarber being a guy, you talked about that maybe his long-term future is at DH. Somebody who's been on the exact path that he's been on is Carlos Santana, who used to be a catcher, moved out of it. You're looking at a situation now, Santana or Napoli going to be in the lineup in Chicago, the other one coming off the bench, and the thought is probably at this point that that's going to be guided by whoever the starting pitcher is and how they would kind of match up with them there. But that's something that's really going to hurt the Indians, because when you take any kind of power out of the Indians lineup, a lineup that's not really brimming with it in the first place, especially at the traditional power spots, corner, outfield, and third base, they make up for a little bit, shortstop, second base, et cetera. Frankie Lindor's had a heck of a postseason. He's going to have an even greater one going forward because, again, as great as the Indians are defensively, the Cubs probably still have the advantage there. The Cubs, as you said, check marks in most of the different areas out there. Sizing this up overall, it is a classic sort of head versus heart conundrum on this. When I did my NBA final preview with Ben Chu back in June, that was a point where both were in alignment. I really believed that the Cavs were going to come through. I said Cavs in six, largely because I couldn't envision the Cavs winning a game seven in Golden State. So that was a failure of imagination on my part. This time, I would say that dichotomy returns. I certainly see a circumstance where the Indians can pull this thing off, but it's going to have to be even greater magic bursts than we've seen thus far. And against a team that I just keep calling them a cyborg. They just don't really have too many weaknesses out there. You're just going to have to be perfect for nine innings or maybe more than nine innings every night to beat them. So heart says Indians, and the head says that they can, but gun to my head, I'll say Cubs in six.
And I'll agree with that pick. Again, we both picked the Cubs before the beginning of the season and certainly before the beginning of the playoffs. It's amazing that the Indians are here, and all credit to Francona and the pitching coach, Callaway, as you talked about. But I think there's just too much to trot out the three guys they're going to trot out. And I don't know, you know, there's a few things here. I think if the – it's interesting that the World Series was always set up from pretty much the 30s to the 80s, where your star pitcher could pitch three games on regular rest, 3 days rest, 1-4-7. Mickey Lolich comes to mind, beating the Cardinals in 68, when even though Denny McClain was the 30-game winner, for example. But I always thought that was unfair, frankly. I think with the whole DH thing, I think it's unfair to the American League team, whatever team that is, because obviously you already talked about it with Napoli and Santana, whereas if you're the National League team, it's not so hard. You can, frankly, take out you can have your best hitter who's not a regular or who is weak in the field play those extra games. So I've always thought that was unfair. Whatever you think of the DH, I certainly wasn't a fan at the beginning. I understand the reason for it. But to have Major League Baseball play, and, you know, people have talked about this now for 40 years. It started in 73. To have two different leagues with two different rules and have those rules collide in the World Series where you do the home and away always struck me and still strikes me as bizarre, but I believe always puts the American League team at a bit of an disadvantage. Because now when you go – I'm sorry, it puts the National League team, I'm sorry, a bit of a disadvantage. I don't know how this can be resolved, Rick. I don't know if 1 year you would play with a DH everywhere and 1 year you would play without a DH everywhere in all the games. I just don't understand how you can change the rules literally in the middle of a series, which is what you do. Obviously, the first two games in Cleveland, you know, there'll be a DH in the next three, which would lead me to my other complaint, which is how can the All-Star game – I think the Cubs have an argument, you know, about having the best record in baseball, clearly having the best record in baseball, and now it's the All-Star game where you get the home field advantage. So there are problems here. Maybe people will say, oh, that all that stuff doesn't matter. But I do think when you when you are an American League team and then you have to put an extra guy in the field, I think that weakens it. And I think that's a problem. Whereas, again, the Cubs, Schwarber, a good example. Now, you don't want him on the field even if he was 100% healthy. He would probably be, suppose he had played the whole year, he would probably be the guy they take off the field. So I'm disappointed in those kinds of big picture rules in baseball, but that is what we have. You know, the rules are the rules. So I have Cubs in six as well. I just think their starting pitching is too much. And we'll see, because I think you're dealing with the two best managers, although I agree with you on Bochy. He's in the conversation as well.
Well, maybe it's just my own rampant self-pity at work here, but to me, it's the American League team at the disadvantage, because this lineup is built around, power-wise, Napoli and Santana combining for, I think, like 68 home runs between them, and now one of the three can't play in Chicago. So I'm not really wiping too many tears away for whatever disadvantages, quote-unquote, the Cubs are going to have when they come to Cleveland, because they're not losing a foundational member of their lineup for those three games.
Oh, I hope I didn't misspeak. I agree with that. That's what I was trying to say. Maybe,
okay.
If I said it backwards, I apologize. But
that's
thought
hilarious.
I said,
okay.
I thought no, I could have misspoke. I thought I said the Napoli Santana
thing.
Okay,
I think I misunderstood you.
No, I might have misspoke. I think the Napoli Santana
thing.
Napoli Santana is the thing you point to for the problem. And that is the problem, whereas, again, I hope I said, when the National League team comes to Cleveland, they can, I just use Schwarber as an example, they can, take a guy, essentially take a guy out, add their worst fielding person to play as a hitter, and that'll be Schwarber addition now because of the injury. But, again, I think his future is in the American League.
It may very well be. So we're both saying Cubs in six. That's what I think is most likely to happen. But, again, as I say, I'm going to leave myself wiggle room here so nobody around here throws garbage at me in this town. But I believe that, again, there is still a path for the Indians. There probably wasn't a path on paper to get through Boston. I don't know about Toronto, because they didn't have as much power top to bottom as the Red Sox did, albeit their pitching was a little bit better. But, again, the Indians have had to defy the odds thus far. They've been a team of destiny, a lot like 97. It reminds me a lot of the 97 team. Of course, I also remember how that ended. So myself and everybody else hoping for that to go a different way. And to conclude this ultimate year of destiny in Cleveland, which, again, all the things I mentioned before and the civic pride of, again, it's very, very tough to host a political convention post 9/11 with all the other things going on. This year for Cleveland and Philadelphia, and again, just for what it's worth, I'm going to give the little neener that there seemed to be a consensus from the national media that Cleveland's was just a little better than Philadelphia's. But be that as it may, they were both winners for avoiding problems in this very 1968-type year we've been having in America. So this winning streak that has enveloped Cleveland has been very unexpected but very welcome. And I certainly hope it concludes with a World Series title in another 10 days or so. But regardless, it's going to be a blast watching it, and it's always a blast breaking it down with you, my friend. I look forward to our subsequent conversations on the show about baseball and other things. Thank you so much for making time for us today.
Yeah, if I can give you one more thing in 30 seconds.
Yes.
I wonder what the story is in Cleveland. You might know this. Eddie Robinson is the only surviving member of the 1948 Indians. He's all of World Series Indians, and he was a very good player if you look him up on Baseball Reference. He's alive. He's 95. He's also the oldest living Yankee, still living Yankee.
Oh.
And there was a big article in the Daily News, the New York Daily News, that I encourage all the Cleveland people to read, where the guy's upset because nobody has called him. Now, I was hoping that article, which was in the paper about 3 days ago, I was hoping that article will get somebody to get this guy there. Whatever you think of Charlie Sheen and him throwing out the first or whatever, this guy was an excellent player, a four-time All-Star, was very good for the 48 Indians, started at first base in the World Series, had some big hits, is a walking history book as far as I'm concerned, and yet he said as of 3 or 4 days ago he hadn't heard from the Indians. So I hope that got to somebody in the hierarchy in Cleveland, because they should find a way to get this guy any way they can to get him to Cleveland, if not for game one, then for game two. It's an amazing story, and you can just Google it, you know, Eddie Robinson, Cleveland Indians, New York Daily News. It's a fascinating story, and I looked him up on Baseball Reference. He was a very good, he was a four-time All-Star. I had never heard of him, frankly, but he's the only surviving member of the 1948 Cleveland Indians winning World Series team, and that should count for something, Rick.
Yeah, that's good to know. I had not heard that, so... Yeah, he's very deserving. When we're talking about who should throw out a first pitch for one of the games in Cleveland, he should be probably right there at about the head of the line. And one more thing as well to mention, history to be made next weekend. This will be the first time ever, I guess, in terms of the timing of the 95 World Series, what it was, and in 97 with the World Series, the Browns were gone already. It will be the first weekend ever to have Browns, Cavs, and Indians games. So the Browns will fittingly be the skid mark on that whole thing there. But never before, I guess, have the three teams played in the same weekend. And that will all happen next weekend one way or another. And, again, hopefully nothing but good things for the Tribe and also for the Cavs opening up their season as we record this tomorrow night. The banner ceremony right across the plaza, the banner and ring ceremony, and hopefully a moment of silence for the great Nate Thurman, which I'm sure will be the case because – how can you raise a banner in the balcony without paying tribute to somebody who's already represented there? So a very emotional once-in-a-lifetime night for Cleveland tomorrow evening. And as we're recording this, the start of the World Series across the plaza from the queue at the Jake. And, again, this is going to be so much fun to watch. And, again, we're going to have fun breaking this all down subsequently. Thank you so much for your time, my good friend Steve Callis.
Always great to be with you, Rick. Look forward to doing it again.
Really appreciate it, my friend, for you making the time for us. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in to FDH Lounge Mini Episode number 772.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, all Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.